Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My co-host today is John Gee. We may be joined through the podcast by John Thompson, our other co-host. But in the meantime, our discussion topic for today is an interview with Lincoln Blumel, who is the author of a new book from Fortress with an important biblical discovery. But before we get to that, I just want to remind you that the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you, whether it's podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, or scripture roundtables. You can find it here, and you can especially find it at the interpreterfoundation.org website. Now, if you like this podcast, tell your friends about it or give us a rating. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Libsyn, or any other podcast app that you use. Now, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Now, our discussion topic today is with author Lincoln Blumel, who, as I mentioned, has written a new book. Lincoln, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about your new book, and I'm a little hesitant to pronounce it. Our listeners know my pronunciation is a little off at times, so I'm going to let you, as the author, give us the correct pronunciation.
You bet. The title is Lady Eclecte, The Lost Woman of the New Testament. Just came out a couple weeks ago with Fortress Press. The name, it's a Greek name. The Latin form would be Electa for the name. And yeah, it's really a
Is the
remarkable
sea silent?
Book. In the Greek, right, we have the kappa. It's a hard, you know, kappa, lecte. And then Latin's a little bit for their word elect. Electus, electa in the feminine, a little bit different for the adjective of. A Latinized form of the name would be Electa.
So I mean, I've read 2 John my whole life. I know that this is something, but apparently this book talks about a discovery that you made that's a big deal. And in fact, this weekend you just got back from the Society of Biblical Literature where you gave a presentation on it. Tell us a little about that, if you would. And then we'll dive into the book.
You bet. So I was in back east in Boston over the weekend for the annual meeting, the Society of Biblical Literature, largest biblical studies meeting in the world. And in the papyrology session, I gave a paper on this discovery, thinking about how I came across it and why this reading is the only reading that works in the address of 2 John. Currently, when you read 2 John in Greek, the way it's rendered in every English translation is the elder to either the elect lady or an elect lady. But in fact, what's given as an adjective there is actually should be a proper name. So it should be the elder to the lady eclecte or lecta, if you use the Latinized form, which I think is a really important discovery. That's what my paper was on, that whole process. Many parts of that, we'll get into that. Because this now makes this letter the only one addressed to a named woman in the entire New Testament. So I think that's really quite significant.
And how was that received?
You know, it was received, pretty well I, with those in the audience. The book's now getting out, making some traction. And so I suspect here probably in the new year at some point, I'll be seeing some reviews. But when I presented a few times at some academic conferences, both here in the U.S. and abroad, and overwhelmingly the feedback has been positive. You know, some people when they first hear this are kind of, they say, it's really interesting, we want to think about this and process this for a while. But I haven't had anybody come back and say, no, this cannot be the reading. And, you know, one of the things I really get into is the Greek of how you have, you know, printed for 2 John 1, how it's rendered in modern Greek editions, simply does not work when you're dealing with, you know, the way they write ancient letters. And what's really key is when you compare it to the address in 3 John 1, that's also written by the elder or the presbyter, it's totally different as it currently stands. And this reading makes the collocation the same. And so it actually fits really well with how letters are typically addressed in the Roman period, so the first 2 centuries. And so it works remarkably well. And really, it's the only way that makes sense of an otherwise obscure Greek passage at the start of the letter.
So now, tell us what kind of led you to this reading.
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things I do is I work a lot with Greek papyri. And so I spend a lot of my time editing texts from ancient Egypt, from kind of, like the Ptolemaic periods from about the 3rd century BC, all the way up to the Arab conquest of Egypt, that are written predominantly in Greek, but also in Coptic. And one of the things I love doing is I love editing and translating ancient letters. We have lots of letters preserved on papyrus. It's like the paper of the ancient world. And because of the dry climate of Egypt, we have all kinds of records preserved during this period, of course, even earlier periods and later periods. And I've done a lot of work with letters. I've published letters, I've translated them, written books on letters. And one of the things you'll notice with letters is they're very formulaic in certain places. And that typically appears at the start of the letter, in the opening of the letter. It has three parts in a letter where you have a superscription, where Roman period letters always begin with the name or title of the person who's sending the letter. And that's always immediately followed by the name of the recipient. And then a third element is they'll have an address, some kind of greeting, and that might take a few different forms. And so, I've edited a number of letters like this and read a number of letters. Just from the Roman period alone, we have the remains of about probably 2,300 to 2,500 letters written in Greek. So you have a pretty good idea of the formula they use. And when you read 3 John, this is exactly what you get. It begins with the elder. And then right after this, you have, ho presbyteros in Greek, or the elder. And then that third word is Gaius. And so Gaius is addressed there. And that's precisely what you expect in a Roman period letter. The name of the sender followed immediately by the name of the addressee. And then what you have is then you have the beloved, where you have an adjective. And that's really, when to have an adjective, that's the standard. But when you go to 2 John 1, you now have the elder. And the way it's rendered is they tell you, well, you have an adjective, like, and then you have this word curia, which is lady. And so they say, well, in this letter, it's strange because you have an adjective, then followed by a noun. And when you read, like, I've literally read, thousands of letters from the Roman period, edited dozens of letters from this period. It simply does not work. It doesn't actually make sense. So you're kind of wondering, why do you have this strange opening where you starts off, the first thing is an adjective, and then you have a noun, where you expect a proper name, and you might expect a modifier. And one of the things I began thinking about this is because the Greek is strange in the address, overwhelmingly it's interpreted as a metaphor. And this is what I often find something a bit frustrating. If people don't properly understand things, they say, well, it's just a metaphor for something. And that may be the case. There certainly is metaphor in the New Testament, the larger biblical text. But in such a short letter like 2 John, this struck me as, number one, very implausible. And again, I kept on going back saying, why does it begin in this unusual way when 3 John begins in the standard way? And what I began to do is, when you kind of get beyond like a printed Greek text, I kind of imagined, like, what would this have looked like in an original letter? And in ancient Greek, there's no word spacing, there's no capitalization, there's very little punctuation. And so all these things are added interpretive elements. And in ancient Greek, a lot of people's names are what we would call simple Greek names, meaning they're undifferentiated from a noun or an adjective. So take the name Stephen. Stephanos in Greek, it means, of course, the name Stephen, but also means crown. And so when you're reading an ancient Greek text, I mean a truly ancient Greek text, if it's an inscription or papyrus, it's not going to differentiate that with capitalization. Context will tell you, is this talking about a crown or is it actually a personal name? And so you have this word eklekte, which, yes, it's the adjective elect, but it also is a woman's name. Women have this name, much as men have the name eklekta, which would be the masculine form of this. And when I realized this, and then realized that the way this name ends, it ends with a tau eta, And what you have in Greek letters is you always have, right, the name of the person. They'll often have a modifier, like, Gaius the beloved, the. And in the Greek case here with the woman, it'd be eklekte, ending with a tau eta. And then the would be another tau eta. And then you have kuria for lady. And in most Greek manuscripts, you just have eklekte kuria. But in some, and no one's ever noticed the significance of this, they read eklekte te kuria, where you have the tau eta repeated. And that's now the, and that makes it certain you can only read it as a proper name. So it has to be the elder to the lady eklekte, or literally eklekte the lady. And it would then fit perfectly with what you have in standard openings of addresses. And just a final note here on this, as I was, going through this, make this discovery, I was curious about what were early Christians saying about the opening of this letter. And so I looked at every early Christian reference, whether in Greek or Latin. I included Coptic and Syriac for the first 1,000 years. And there's not a whole lot said about 2 John 1. In fact, most of the early Christian discussion, a lot of Christians are wondering who is the elder. So there's all kinds of theories. Is this John the Apostle? Is this someone else? And our earliest commentator actually talks about the recipient is a writer called Clement of Alexandria. He lives at the turn of the second, beginning of the third century. And in a work of his that's no longer extant, it's been lost. We have Latin extracts from a later writer from the sixth century. He has a quick sketch on 2 John. And one of the things he says there, and he's our very earliest Christian commentator, he said it was written to a woman by name Eclecta. And so this is our
Oh.
very earliest commentator. So when you actually fit this all together, you fit the Greek, doesn't make sense, it presently reads. You actually recognize the reading and how literally a reduplicated data dropped out a number of manuscripts, it appears in others. When you then realize that, in fact, our earliest Christian commentator actually mentions this, it all came together. It makes perfect sense. This would then be addressed to a woman. And actually, you read it this way, it makes far more sense when you look at a letter addressed to an actual woman as opposed to a metaphor, a woman personified as a church.
So you make it sound so straightforward. How long did this take? And John, you're just laughing. Both of you are actually laughing. But obviously, this took a while.
It did take a while, and you know what? I think one of the things that enabled me to see this was having a certain skill set. A lot of people just they don't see this, but it was dealing with papyri and ancient texts where I'm constantly editing a text, right? We have modern, when we write a document, we have spell checkers, grammar checkers, all these things. Ancients don't have this, and so spelling. Orthography can be quite unique with phonetic changes. They'll drop, articles, add things, terminate words in a wrong way. And so, whenever I read an ancient text, you just kind of get used to this. And so, you're saying, okay, the text says this on the page, but in fact, this is what they mean, and here's how it should be written in Greek. And then when you see this in letters, and so that helped me to see this in the text, see something that no one else has seen. And say, wait a second, this doesn't actually work. And here's how it should be properly restored. And so when I made this discovery, this was back in the initial, this card coming was in 2023 as I was working on some inscriptions in Egypt. It's been kind of about a little over a 2-year process by the time you do that, write the book, and then it eventually comes through to publication.
Well, this is a pretty, I mean, most books of this nature take longer than 2 years. So it
Yes.
seems like it was a really quick process. I mean, I was captivated when I read your first experience about the police report. I said, "Oh, okay." I mean, you talk about how you went line by line to look up the story of this woman who filed a police report. Her husband ran off with some sailor and he never came home, and the sailor came back wearing his clothes. And then we don't hear anything else about the story. I was telling my wife how cool this was, and she's like, "And your point?" But I was captivated by it, and then I all of a sudden realized how easy it would be to get passionate about this kind of thing, and it obviously comes through in your work there. But when you present, you've had good responses from the scholarly community, but what are you hearing that they're going to, I mean, are they going to change some of what they say in their commentaries going forward? I know you have a commentary in the works. It's probably a little ways out. Obviously, you would take advantage of this in your publication, but what do you hear from some of the others?
You know, I would, well, I'm going to think really big here and say I would love it if in future versions the biblical texts were changed. This does happen. You know, there's a standard Greek, there's a couple standard Greek editions of the New Testament. One is the United Bible Society. They issue, right, kind of a Greek rendering, you know, every, you know, decade or so. There's also Nestle-Aland version, it's a standard Greek, you know, academic version, where they will update readings based on manuscripts and things like that. And so I would be thrilled if it were to happen. And all I'm arguing is for the addition of two letters, two reduplicated letters that got dropped out because of haplography, where scribe at some point skipped over these because you have like a Taweda Taweda. And so Eklekte Te Kuria became Eklekte Kuria, which doesn't make sense in epistolary greetings. And so I would love it if that were the case. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. I guess, you know, time will tell how this is received. But I think it's a really significant discovery. And, you know, going back to one of the things I love about doing, you know, work on ancient texts is I just love, you know, meeting people, and all that is left of their life might be a small papyrus of, I don't know, 3 by 5 inches that preserves part of a letter or a police report or a petition for something. You get like a quick snapshot into their life. And so this one you'd mentioned, it was the first piece I ever edited as a graduate student. It was a police report from a city in Egypt, written by a woman. In fact, I can even, you know, pin down, you know, the day and year and kind of then convert that to our calendar. It was right at the end of the 3rd century. And it just got me hooked. It was very hard work when you're looking at ancient document, right? There's holes in it. You know, it's a hard hand to read. There's no word division, spelling errors. But kind of, you know, getting into the story, I just became hooked. And so even things, you know, like, you know, as mundane as tax receipts and other items, land divisions, I found, you know, it just been really interesting. We kind of have this unique kind of evidence. That's why I really love letters, because it talks a lot about people often and interpersonal relationships. And so for me, I kind of find this as an extension of my work of kind of bringing people to light. And, you know, something when we think about, you know, what would I hope happen here? And I'd love if this were to be the reading, you know, at some point made into the biblical. Is, you know, if I were to find, let's just say, you know, let's say we didn't know about 2 John, and I was to find it in Egypt just recently, and let's say it had this shorter reading, right? Eklekte Kuria. Because the reading doesn't actually make sense, if I were to publish that text, no one would ever publish it as the elder to the elect lady, because they're like, it grammatically doesn't make sense. It's very clearly should be Eklekte Te Kuria. We have numerous examples where the same kind of error appears in inscriptions, in papyri, all over the place. It would everybody say, well, of course, it's just the elder to the lady Eklekte. People wouldn't even think twice about it. In fact, if I submitted that to a journal, they would not publish it unless that were the reading. And I would put say, look, we have to restore, you know, a that was dropped. But of course, as you well know, the minute you touch the biblical text, the rules change dramatically. When you say, hey, there is a subtle error in this. And so here's some of my thoughts on that. But yeah, that would be a hope that, yeah, this would actually impact the text.
Well, you've been assigned the Johannine epistles for the BYU New Testament commentary. I presume you're going to include it, right?
Yeah, I certainly, you know, that still, as you mentioned, some ways off, but that will be something I will certainly include. And certainly have a long discursus talking about kind of history of this and inform, you know, people on the readings that have been given and give some context. But yeah, I would certainly include that there and say, yeah, this is the best reading on a number of levels for this letter.
So just to give Terry, you'd ask about how the long this would take. Since they just released a new edition of United Bible Societies, and they only do that about every 10 years. It's going to take at least 10 years to get into the standard edition that students would read.
Although, would it be available online earlier?
I can't say on that. I'm just talking just sort of how you would forecast this. People would pick up his book, might read it. I still use the third edition, even though the sixth edition just came out, if I use it.
You're sounding old, John.
I do sound old. So it might be 20 or 30 years before this starts working its way into things like popular commentaries. And so sometimes things go faster, but a lot of times it takes a while for discoveries like this to work their way into the standard scholarship. But oftentimes they do work their way in and stick.
So, Lincoln, tell us a little more about this this hidden comment from Clement that apparently had been lost but was later reported a few hundred years later.
Yeah, so you have this really interesting interpreter, an early Christian interpreter, Clement of Alexandria, who writes, a number of texts. Only a small portion of his corpus is survived, and we have reports. Our earliest report is there is a church historian called Eusebius of Caesarea, and he writes this church history in 10 books, and he talks about Clement of Alexandria being this scholar. And he says that Clement wrote this book. It's in Greek, it's called Hupotopeses, but it just means sketches. Where he says he writes this great book, kind of giving commentary on all these biblical texts. And the book ultimately, falls out of use. In fact, we know much later, Christians, now going about 600 years later, don't like some of the things Clement is saying. And so, they seem to, no longer copy the book. They actually view him in some ways. Some of his theology is suspect. You'll find this often. Sometimes early Christians, their theology is suspect by Christians of, hundreds of years later. But there is a Christian writer, a Latin writer called Cassiodorus, and he, in the Byzantine period, kind of creates kind of a Christian center on his family's estate, and so he'll do a lot of writing in Latin, and so he writes a book on divine and secular learning, and there he talks about copying texts and things like that. So he talks about Clement of Alexandria, and how he writes this text, and saying that he has some good commentary on the Catholic epistles, and in the corpus of Cassiodorus, we actually have some of these, quick sketches, like commentary that Clement was making on four letters. And it's a brief commentary on 2 John. It only occupies about, a little over a paragraph. But he starts off by saying this is written to a woman by name. Now, he says some other things about the letter that people say, okay, that's not in the letter. And I think Clement reads things in. But clearly, Clement is reading the letter where he's taking the third word of the letter as a proper name. And so for me, this is really significant that our earliest Christian commentary is reading it in this way. And we have cases where we have, in the biblical text today, I can give you one from Matthew 27, where we have a writer who comes after Clement, a man called Origen. And he talks about in his commentary on Matthew, where he talks about that some manuscripts mention the name Jesus Barabbas instead of just Barabbas. In fact, we have just Barabbas in the King James today. And he says, well, this can't be the case because no evildoer could be called Jesus Barabbas. And while you don't have the reading Jesus, Barabbas, at least the Jesus part in early manuscripts, you find it in later manuscripts. And as such, the United Bible Society, in fact, the Nestle-Aland, ultimately put this in the text. This has got to be the preferred reading, and we know it's there in the time of Origen, even though it doesn't appear in a number of early manuscripts. You do have evidence for this later manuscripts because the feeling was there may have been some theological agenda to omit the name Jesus. And so there is kind of a bit of a parallel for this, although in this case, I say the evidence for reading this as Lady Eclectae, I think, is far, far stronger. than that. We have manuscripts. They are later, although we don't have great manuscript evidence for hundreds of years. We have two manuscripts that the reading for 2 John 1, Codex Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. But then the next manuscripts for the next 400 years, they're all damaged in the place, so you can't actually say for sure what the reading is. And just when you look at the collocation, it makes perfect sense. So I think there's all kinds of grounds. And so it's fascinating that our earliest Christian commentary actually says this. And by the way, what's interesting is I looked at Christian commentary. When you get into the 6th, 7th centuries, Christians want to prefer that it is a church, and certainly later. And so you'll find in later manuscripts, they'll even gloss it. They'll actually even put in, right, for the word lady, saying it's a church that's being written to. They like that better. That interpretation, it will take hundreds of years, but that will actually become dominant. And that's, of course, dominant today in scholarship. But it's not the original one, right? The first one we have is written to an actual named woman.
To a woman. So I know John's got another question, but I wanted to ask you, you said you were on a dig in Egypt in 2023, kind of when this started to kick in for you. John, weren't you there? Or were you on that dig? Or I remember you came back from one of the digs and you said, "Hey, there's a lot of interesting stuff, but I can't talk about it." Now, maybe you guys communicated. I don't know.
Well, I've been hearing about this for a couple of years. I don't remember if that was the time we were in the. I don't think that was in the time we were in, stuck in the same room on the dig. But part of when. I think what I referred to then is if you discover something on a dig in Egypt, then the Antiquities Authority has to announce it. And so if you jump the gun, you get in trouble with the authorities. So it's certain things you don't want to talk about until they officially say something on it. And also, it's just a matter of scholarly courtesy. When somebody else has discovered something and they're working it up for publication, you don't spread it around their results until they've had a chance to do it. It's just professional courtesy. But I did want to, so we've only got a few minutes, not too many minutes left, and I wanted to ask Lincoln. Tell us about now that you've discovered this woman and she's got a letter to her. Tell us what, reading it that way, what we can know about the woman to whom this is written.
That's a really good and when you look at this letter, and here's something I we've been so focused on, Lady Eclecte, but there's actually a secondary addressee in the letter. It says the Lady Eclecte and her children. And so traditionally this was looked at, well, there's a church metaphor, right, with a woman, and then you have the children of the congregants. And so what you have with this letter is we have written to this lady, and it mentions children. Now, of course, the question is, okay, how do we take these children? You could take it literally and say, okay, it's written to a woman and her literal children. That is not beyond the realm of possibility. When you look at Greek papyrus letters, you'll have letters periodically addressed to children, using the same Greek word that's used in 2 John 1. I think there's a strong probability they're actually children. It's not being used metaphorically. But what you'll notice is when you start reading down in 2 John, the elder then says, I'm so happy that I hear my children, right? They're walking in the truth. And you have the same language in 3 John 1. And I think it's such that when you think about children here, I'm not inclined to take them as the actual, literal biological children of Eclectic. But it's pretty clear that what this tells us is this woman has some position of authority where people are called her metaphorical children, just like the elder will talk about, well, I have children. Paul will talk about having children. They're not actual children. And so there is a letter written to this woman. She has a position of authority. She's trusted by the elder, and she has people that are, relying on her authority, and they're also being addressed here. And when you read this letter, for me, what really jumps out with this reading is down in verse 10, it mentions a house. And I think the best way to read this is to connect Eclecte with the house, where she's likely the proprietor of this home. And we do know that Christians, not exclusively, but primarily met in the homes of its members. We can read about, house churches in Paul's letters. In fact, what's interesting is we have there's a couple notable cases of women where congregations were meeting in their homes. We have the case of Lydia, where she's a convert in Caesarea, or in Philippi. Letter when Paul is there in the book of Acts. And we also have in Colossians, there's a woman called Nympha in Acts 4:15. Now, I just want to clarify the Nympha, because some of the readers say, I've never read about Nympha in the King James. Well, in the King James, it reads Nymphas as it's a man, but it's come to light, in more recent scholarship, it's actually a woman, Nympha. And so I would add then Eclecte is associated with this home. And I think the best reading is there is a gathering there where people are being instructed, and the elders write to her because it seems she has some authority to control access to this home. Because one of the things he says, if any people, right, come to your home bearing a certain doctrine, in fact, in a few verses earlier, he calls them antichrists. They deny that Jesus come in the flesh. He says, don't greet them, don't let them in the home. And so she has this kind of authority as a gatekeeper. There's probably other elements of the authority there, but that comes out most clearly. And so he's saying, don't allow these people in because people are congregating there. And then the elder says, I want to come and personally speak with you face to face. And so I think we're seeing into an early Christian gathering that's happening at a home where likely Eclecte is the owner of the home, has position of authority, and can regulate who can come in, who has access. I think there's likely some missionary work going on here also, where it's expected that people might actually pass through. In fact, when you think about Eclecte, it seems if we go over to 3 John, that she probably has some authority, not unlike a man called Diotrephes, although he's doing this in a bad way, he's not letting people into, and there he actually uses the word church. But she has this position, and I think it's really quite remarkable. We're now seeing yet another woman, like a Nympha or a Lydia, that we can now add this to this growing number of women in the New Testament that have a position of authority and are playing an active role within the church, and certainly it seems to be some missionary efforts.
That's great. There's also a chapter. John didn't point out the chapter, but there's an entire chapter where you expand on your comments here that's really helpful at the end of the book.
Yeah, I try to, after kind of establishing the reading, I say, okay, what does this reading mean? And I try to just give some options here and saying, okay, what's going on in this letter? How can we read this? Because one of the things you have with letters, there's always a lot of implied information. Like when we write emails, letters today, we don't spell out everything explicitly. It's just kind of implied. We have a shared context. And so there's a lot of that, in every New Testament letter. We're getting, in some sense, half a conversation. And so what I try to say is, without rushing too far, is saying, okay, what are some scenarios that could be going on here that seem likely based on what we're getting from the information of the letter? I think there's probably more that can be done here. I expect that people kind of pick this torch up and run with this, but being cautious, saying, here's what I would cautiously say now based on this letter, what we can see Eclecte doing. And I certainly see here the contours of a congregation. I see some missionary work and her role in acting as a gatekeeper in this, and she's implicitly trusted by the elder in this, that she can, do the things that he's actually requesting. And the fact that she has some children of her own seems to, again, reinforce this notion, just as the elder has, refers to people as children, that she's looked upon having some position of authority and responsibility in this community.
Okay, John, any other questions?
Something else you talked about in the book, but might be interested to our readers if we've got a few minutes. I think we have about 5 left.
Actually,
So
seven.
this is something that runs counter to a lot of scholarship in the area. Actually, I think I'm going to change the question. So, what advice would you give to members of the church who have these, or because New Scholarship comes out, and this has been in all of these commentaries since, and scholars have missed this before. And part of it is they don't have your specialized skill set. But what would you say about how you go about finding things out and straightening out things that aren't correct in the scholarship that's available to most people?
That's a great question and a very big question. I think, the one of the things we should always do, always be suspicious of scholarship. And I don't mean this to demean scholarship. I think scholars most part are trying to do the best they can, but recognize that scholarship will change. It has changed and actually can change quite dramatically. In fact, I argue here, this is a total shift and how this is viewed. In fact, when it was interesting, I read scholarship. Everybody talked about this was like this is an open and shut case. There's no need to say anything. And so people didn't say anything. They just kept on repeating what had been said the last 150 years. It never actually dealt with substantive issues. They never really got down to the bedrock. One of the things with our reading of ancient texts is before we start making interpretations, let's actually figure out what the text says. Make sure we have our Greek right. And once we have it right, okay, now we start making some interpretations. And so I would tell people who hear about, well, this is definitely the theory or not, do always have some reservation, because there was and is total consensus on this position in scholarship. I think this would be changing somewhat, certainly in the coming years. Again, it's not a criticism on scholarship, but you trust that as people get more information, new resources or new sources are available, it can shape the way we have read a text traditionally. And so this is a caveat I'd mention, where people, not just this, interpretive theory, but all kinds of interpretive theories, recognizing that we don't always have as much evidence as we want. And I saw this with here, people often kind of fill in the gaps and often say far more than was actually there. And then as it just got repeated over the decades, it's became, gospel truth. And so, you need to, push back, but I would always just be hesitant.
I'd call it a healthy skepticism.
I think that would be really good. A healthy skepticism, when you look at some of this, not in a demeaning way, but I think it's always a good approach to have. When you actually get in some of the evidence and the sources, realizing how some of these things are built up, there is a lot of theoretical framework, where I think it's a responsible position to have some healthy skepticism.
I mean, I couldn't help think when I was thinking about your experience announcing this, presenting at SBL, about one that John and I talked about on this program a few years ago involving the gospel of Jesus's wife, Karen King, who just went out there kind of on her own and did this big reveal, and then it turned out to be a forgery and all led to all kinds of problems. Fascinating story about scholarship and a particular failure. So I do appreciate the way you've been going about this, very cautious and very, but very confident.
And very thorough. That's one of the things that I wanted. Anybody is worth picking up the book. The book is, even though it deals with a technical matter, is a fairly easy read, and it's very thorough.
Yeah, I haven't
And
quite finished it yet, but it's been very accessible to me, and I don't know Greek from Greek, you know? I mean, I know a little bit, but very little. I'd be in your non-credit beginner class, Lincoln, in Greek, if it was me. So, I just have really appreciated it. It's very down to earth, even though, like John says, it does cover some technical subject matter. You've done a great job of explaining it. So, I recommend the book for those who are interested. It's called Lady Eclecta, Eclectae, E.
yep.
Yeah.
Lady Eclecte.
Lady Eclectae. Good, we got it. Published by Fortress. We don't always see, I mean, we're getting more and more of a Latter-day Saint scholar footprint in Oxford, in Rutledge, in even, I was just thinking of somebody else, Erdmans, but I haven't seen one with Fortress yet. You're one of the first, so kudos to you.
I was really excited. They're a good publisher. They have a really big biblical reach, a lot of good commentary and stuff. So I thought it'd be an ideal publisher to really get this out. And they're really fantastic to work.
All righty. Well, thank you for being with us, Lincoln. This is Terry Hutchinson and John Gee, along with Lincoln Boumel. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Interpreter Foundation podcast. Thanks for being with us.